We're towards the end of the Sefer, and of course the end of Shmuel Bet is a discussion of the unfolding of the consequences of sin, that although David HaMelech in some sense was forgiven, but nevertheless there's a succession of evil that comes from his own family that is also connected to some degree with sexual impropriety, such as Avshalom sleeping with the 10 concubines or maids of his father and the like. And this was a fulfillment of Natan's statement to David that there will be a ra'ah, there will be an evil that will come mi beitecha, from your very home, from your very family. And of course it gives us a graphic description of David running away from Yerushalayim, literally fearful for his own life, going up the Har HaZeitim, going up the Mount of Olives, looking back at the city of Yerushalayim. Of course, we don't know exactly what he was seeing at the time. Obviously, there was no Beit HaMikdash, but he's walking up the Har HaZeitim, and he prays to Hashem that he be allowed one day to be able to return. And it basically goes into a considerable detail about, you know, who's his friend, you know, the old situation of the fair-weather friend. Who are the people that stick with him in this time of sorrow? And who are the people that reject him? There's Hushai, again, there's a whole list of characters, some of which only make their appearance in this story. Hushai is an elderly person who is apparently, in fact, it's interesting that in Divrei HaYamim, it gives a list in Shmuel as well, but the differences are a little different. It gives a list of David's cabinet, as it were, you know, people who are the secretary and the scribe. So there's actually a position called King's Friend. Hey, David. And of course, you know, we know that presidents always have to call him the first friend. There actually is such a unofficial title. And there was, now, the king's confidant, where he could let his hair down and be himself and probably not go hunting. That was never a Jewish thing per se, although David does boast about the fact that he smote the lion and the bear, but that was in the context of being a shepherd protecting his sheep. So Hushai is actually described as having this role, although apparently, well, we're not really sure. I mean, David tells him he's too old to come along, but that doesn't necessarily mean he's older than David. David, at this time, is also not especially young. According to a rabbinic tradition, this is the last 3 years of David's reign, so he's 67. According to the simple meaning of the verse, he would be 70, because remember, there's a reference there, this happened the 40th year. Now, if the 40th year meant the 40th year of his reign, he would be 70. According to rabbinic tradition, the 40th year means this had been 40 years since Bnei Yisrael had asked for a king, which was before Shaul. But be it as it may, David is between the ages of 67 and 70. Hushai, therefore, might be, you know, he's past retirement, whatever it is, and as a result, David feels that Hushai should stay. And keep in mind, therefore, that there are two groups of friends that the narrative is concerned with. One group of friends and allies go with David, and there's a smaller group who are given a mission to stay in the city, stay in Jerusalem, profess loyalty to Avshalom, and as a result serve as a conduit to get certain information back to David so he'll know where he's holding in a given situation. And the three notable people who were specifically requested to remain in Jerusalem and serve as a conduit is, number one, Hushai Ho'erki. Erki is Erek. Hushai Ho'erki. It's a name. Hushai from the city of Erek. Remember, Hushai wanted to go, and David basically said, you're too old, you're going to slow us up. You stay in the city. And the two others are the Kohanim, who are Tzadok and Eviatar. Now, again, I think we went over this last week, but just to go over this very, very briefly. I'm not going to test you on all of the names that are mentioned in Shmuel Bet. For one thing, I don't think I would pass the test. But one should know a little bit about Tzadok and Eviatar and how they connect to the larger story. Again, let me remind you, Eviatar was the sole surviving child Kohen from the massacre of Nov, the city of Kohanim, years before, when David was running away from Shaul. This would be almost 40 years before. So the Kohen that had given David food, his name was Achimelech. Achimelech. And Achimelech was, of course, massacred in Nov. But Eviatar was an orphan who survived that massacre. And David, I won't say David adopted him because there's no indication of a familial connection, so to speak, but David more or less took Eviatar in as the local Kohen who would be advising him in spiritual matters. And at one point, therefore, Eviatar actually became the Kohen Gadol. Okay, so this is the Eviatar that is now coming out with the Aron HaKodesh. He wants to accompany David with the Ark, and David basically tells him, put the Ark back, and you stay in Jerusalem. Now, the second person is a person who is mentioned here for the only first time as a kind of a co-equal Kohen, and that is a person called Tzadok. Tzadok. Now, it's not really clear where did Tzadok come on the scene. Who is he? Where is he from? Why is he? Oh, I mean, he's not. Remember, these are not the only two Kohanim in the Jewish people, of course, but obviously these are the two leadership Kohanim. Where does Tzadok fit in? So here there is a midrash which the narrative does not make at all clear, and that is that when David consulted Eviatar, who was wearing the Urim v'Tumim, the breastplate by which one is supposed to get prophetic answers, it says Hashem did not give an answer through Eviatar. And therefore that was seen as a divine sign that although Eviatar was still a Kohen, Eviatar was to be replaced by somebody else. And that somebody else who replaced him was a Kohen that is called Tzadok. Now we will see that there's a little bit of a contradiction, because the narrative in Shmuel Bet implies that Tzadok had assumed dominance in the Avshalom story. In fact, we will read in the book of Malachim Aleph that the reason Eviatar was deposed was because in the final rebellion against David, which is after Avshalom, which is Adoniyahu, that's David's last son, Eviatar sided with Adoniyahu, and as a result was replaced by Tzadok. So it could very well be that maybe it's kind of a two strikes and you're out type of situation, meaning to say, Eviatar's days were numbered as Kohen Gadol when the Urim v'Tumim did not work for him, and maybe that is why Eviatar went along with Adoniyahu, thinking that maybe he would fare better under Adoniyahu, and when that rebellion collapsed, then essentially Eviatar, well, he was not killed, unlike some other people who rebelled, including Yoav, who went with Adoniyahu. He was not killed, but he was kind of banished from officiating as the Kohen Gadol. So it's kind of a two strikes and you're out. And from then on, this is very important, all of the Kohanim Gedolim, for the duration of the first, at least the first temple, were the descendants of this Tzadok. So the truth of the matter is this Tzadok assumes kind of an immense proportion in the prophetic books that, you know, you don't really see from the actual autobiographical details of his life. For example, in the book of Yechezkel, where Ezekiel has prophecies about the future Geulah, the Mashiach, it talks about God's promise that righteous Kohanim will come from B'nai Tzadok. And of course that's a bit of a pun, because Tzadok itself is righteous. And there is a real concept that Tzadok is the progenitor of all future Kohanim Gedolim. So although, as I say, you don't really see any particular, at least in the narrative, any particular distinction that Tzadok had, other than he was obviously very loyal to David, but indeed the Kohen Gedolah comes through his seed. And you'll notice, if you run a concordance, you will see that in the books of the later prophets, the B'nai Tzadok are very, very prominent. Now the reason I mentioned during the first temple and the Mashiach is that during the second temple, things were a bit different, because at various times, for the entire period of the second temple, the Jews in Israel were under foreign domination. First it was Persia. In fact, the second temple was built with the Rishut of Cyrus. And in fact, just to give people a perspective, this is probably obvious, but sometimes people don't connect it. The Purim story happens during the 70 years of exile, between the destruction of the first temple and the building of the second temple. And in fact, in the book of Ezra, we are told that when Cyrus the Great gave permission to rebuild the second temple, in the middle of the construction process, it was halted, because the enemies of the Jews, the Samaritans, had spread rumors that the Jewish people are building the temple as a focal point to overthrow the Persian government. Now, according to rabbinic tradition, the king who stopped the construction of the temple after Cyrus had authorized it was none other than King Ahasuerus. Again, what's confusing is that these kings had many different names. In the book of Ezra, it is recorded there was a fellow called Artaxerxes, which is Artaxerxes. And Chazal identify Artaxerxes is another name for Ahasuerus. In fact, with the Persian kings anyway, if you know, one of the great puzzles in Jewish chronology is trying to figure out the duration of the Persian rule over Israel. Because according to rabbinic tradition, it is a brief 34 or 35 years. According to secular historians, it's almost 200 years. And therefore, there's a lost, what's called the lost 170 years, which affects the entire chronology of the Second Temple period. So that's a famous puzzle. And in fact, if you're interested, there's even a book that collated all of the solutions that have been offered for this puzzle. So it's one of those things that has, I think it has probably 500 different answers. Of course, the answers can take many different types. One is the Jewish chronology is wrong. Other is the secular chronology is wrong. And the third is the attempt of some type of reconciliation. Some of it is fascinating, some of it is speculative and the like. So I'm not going to resolve that issue right now. But the point is this. The point I'm making is about Kohanim Gedolim. By the way, just another sense. Chazal see a beautiful remes, a beautiful allusion that it was Ahasuerus that stopped the building of the temple. Because you'll remember, whenever Esther approaches him, so he says, what can I do for you, Esther? I will give you up to half of my kingdom. Up to half. Meaning, I will not give you the thing that is in the middle of my kingdom. And this is the tradition that the Beit HaMikdash is the middle of the world. So he says, I'll give you everything, but because he doesn't know she's Jewish, but just in case, he's hedging his bets. But just in case, don't ask me for the Beit HaMikdash. Now, the point is this. So for the entire Second Temple period, Eretz Yisrael was under foreign domination. First the Persians, then eventually what we call the Greeks, but really it was Alexander the Great, his empire, and then eventually the Romans. And for a large amount of that time, particularly during Roman domination, the Kohen Gadol was sold to the highest bidder. It was actually auctioned by the government, and sometimes you didn't even have to be a Kohen to get it, right? Like the old commercial, you don't have to be Jewish to enjoy the rye bread. You don't have to be Jewish to be a Kohen Gadol, or even a Kohen.
Levi's right.
Yeah. Maybe they got it from the Romans, right? Right. Very good. So the thing is that obviously, therefore, the yichus, the lineage from Bnei Tzadok, was not continuous during the Second Temple, but it will be reestablished. That is why, for example, it is said that every year when the Kohen Gadol would officiate in the Holy of Holies, he would often not survive. He would often die. They used to tie a chain to him, so in case he didn't come out, they could drag out the body without having to go into the Holy of Holies. So, which, by the way, shows you the power of ego, because, you know...
How did they clean it if they couldn't go into it?
Well, there were ways. They could, you know, kind of wear goggles. Yeah, they were allowed. I mean, normally it didn't have to be cleaned. I mean, it was only used once a year. But if they go in and they don't, they were lowered in a box and with a hole in it. But you see the power of ego, because here, like this, here, why would people, as it were, buy an office in which apparently you would die, you know, if you were not worthy? Because each person thought, well, maybe I'll be the one that'll have fame and fortune. Maybe I'll make it. I'll go into the Holy of Holies. And I will survive, and I will be, you know, the hero and the special one. Even though statistically it was very clear that, you know, if you were not worthy, you would not make it. But it shows you that people are, well, you see it every day. People are, well, it records something like 300 Kohanim Gedolim over a 420-year period.
Died?
So, yeah. Now, it doesn't mean, I don't think we have to assume that they died instantaneously, because that would have been, I think, maybe too open of a miracle. But whatever, they died very shortly after. They died that year, which was not a good thing to do. But you see that the concept of ego is that a person's desire for the possible glory can override every sane consideration of their life. Which, of course, you know, you see this all the time with daredevils and survivor shows and whatever it is, people think, I'm going to be the one. Yeah.
How were they supposed to be Jews being Kohen Gadol?
Well, a Kohen Gadol is, I would call it a quasi-hereditary office, meaning to say that the first one that has priority in being chosen is the child of the Kohen Gadol. Now, if he's not worthy, theoretically any Kohen can be chosen, and the decision would normally be made by the Sanhedrin, the 71-member courts. So any Kohen could be elevated to Kohuna Gedolah, but there is a priority to keep it hereditary. The same thing is true by kingship. Monarchy, although it is true that monarchy for the first temple was hereditary, but theoretically it does not have to be hereditary. A child or a son is given the first priority, but if the Sanhedrin feels he's not worthy, they can go to someone else. Although it would have to be in the Davidic line, because you know, that was God's promise that the kings would be from David.
Yeah. You just revealed a new facet of the food story that I never considered, but since you said that it happened after Cyrus gave permission to the Jews to return.
Yes.
So one of the solutions could have been when the edict came down to kill all the Jews, they could say, okay, we're going back to Judea.
Well, the problem was Judea was under Persian domination, so it wouldn't have helped. In other words, if Haman had decreed that Jews all over the world will be killed, Aliyah would not have helped. But of course, what you're pointing out highlights the obvious point that in spite of the fact that Cyrus had already allowed the Jews to return to Israel, the vast bulk of the Jewish populations did not return to Israel. They remained in Babylonia, Persia, other countries. In fact, for the entire Second Temple period, the majority of the Jewish population was in the diaspora. See, we sometimes think if only we had a temple, we would all be in Israel.
Same
you know.
Thing today.
Well, that's right. That's right. I mean, today you have the same thing. And basically, this is a very, well, the truth is it's less justifiable today. Because then, life in Israel was much, much harder. If you read the book of Ezra, you've seen the midnight, how the houses were burnt and destroyed, and there was no wall, and there were wild animals all over the place. Basically, but today, of course, there are also great, great challenges, but they're not exactly of the same magnitude. Yeah, but this is the thing. So it is important to know this Eviatar and Sadok, how the Kohen Gadol was removed, technically later in the Book of Kings, from Eviatar, given to Sadok, and from then on, the B'nai Sadok have kind of a hereditary, assuming the children are worthy, right to the Kohen Gadol. Now, Chazal also add another detail. I think, again, I may have mentioned this. And that is Eviatar happened to have been a descendant of Eli.
Of
whom? Of Eli. Eli, the prophet, who was at the very beginning of the book of Shmuel. And God had told Eli that his children would lose their priesthood, as it were, because they abused their position, they desecrated God's name, they abused their power over people who needed to bring the korbanot. And David saw in the fact that Eviatar was no longer answered by the Urim v'Tumim, he saw this as the time in which the prophecy to Eli was to be fulfilled. So that's also what is going on here as well. And therefore there is really a permanent transition. Technically it takes place in the book of Malachim from Eviatar to Sadok. And again, as I say, the B'nai Sadok, the descendants of Sadok, are very, very prominent later on in the story. Now, in addition, so again, just to summarize, there are three loyalists who are told by David to remain in Jerusalem. One is Hushai Hoerki, who will have a pretty important part. And its two others are Sadok and Eviatar, who are the Kohanim. And Eviatar was Kohen Gadol, and Sadok becomes the Kohen Gadol. And then each of them has a son, and again these sons also play a role in being the runners in a very literal sense. Eviatar has a son, Yonatan, not to be confused with David's friend, and Sadok has a son, Achimaaz. And it's interesting, well, okay, we'll say, again, I mean, their role essentially was to be the runners or go-betweens between the information that Sadok and Eviatar acquire in Jerusalem and to somehow get that information from David. And if you recall, there is at least one story in the narrative of these boys, Yonatan and Achimaatz, being sighted at leaving Jerusalem, going towards David's camp, and the soldiers of Absalom wanted to capture them, seeing them as spies, and they were hidden by a woman, and not again a woman, again was instrumental in hiding them, similar to the spies in the book of Yoshua, etc. Now,
was Hushai a Jew? Or
Hushai was a Jew, yeah.
According to?
No. Hushai was just regular Yisrael. Hushai. Now, Hushai plays an important part. Well, among other things, David's greatest fear, we see, is that because Avshalom has the wonderful services of Achitophel, who is David's wisest advisor, David is a little bit afraid that Achitophel will come up with some real good idea that will get rid of him. And therefore, his final prayer as he climbs the Mount of Olives, and you could picture that scene if you know the area in your own mind's eye, towards the Intercontinental Hotel, which wasn't there then, is he prays to God that God should cause the Council of Achitophel to become Sachal. Sachal is, with a samach, is a fool. It's the opposite, right?
Seichel.
Yeah, it's an opposite. Seichel, well, again, this is a good example. The truth is, sin and samach are actually interchangeable letters in Biblical Hebrew anyway. But the concept of words containing their antonyms is a very common feature. For example, lahashrish is both to root something, and to uproot something. So, lissachel can mean to make foolish, to remove the seichel. So God prays that Achitophel's counsel should be rendered null and void. And indeed, Hushai Hoerki is instrumental in Achitophel's counsel being ignored. Now, if you remember, the Pasuk has some very high praise for Achitophel. It says, Achitophel's advice was gold standard. It was as good as something you got from the Urim and Thummim. Right? It says, in those days...
And he was from Avshalom?
Achitophel went to Avshalom, yeah. That's right. I think I had mentioned, the reason for that is, according to the Midrash, is he was Bathsheba's grandfather. So he was not too happy with the way things turned out. Although, again, in point of fact, you could say, gee, things turned out very nicely. Here, Bathsheba was taken from the commoner who died in war. Now she's the king's wife. And now their son, Shlomo, although we don't know if we know that yet, is going to become king. But nevertheless, this kind of left a bad taste in Achitophel's mouth. And as a result, he didn't, according to one tradition, he did not really want to, he just couldn't be the same with David anymore. Although he went to Avshalom, which is hardly an improvement, one would say. In fact, it's an interesting conversation that when Hushai stays in Yerushalayim and pledges allegiance to Avshalom, Avshalom says, why didn't you go with your friends? What are you going to me for? Remember, Hushai even has a job. He's the friend of the king, right? That is his cabinet position, the king's buddy. And Hushai's argument is that, number one, obviously, he makes two interesting arguments. One argument is, well, obviously, God has decided that David is not worthy of rule. That's why he's running away. But then he makes another argument. He says, I am loyal to my friend by being loyal to the son of my friend. Kind of a strange argument, particularly when the son is trying to get rid of the friend. But he says, you know, I am loyal to David by being loyal to his son. So I'm not, you know, I'm not being treacherous in my loyalty. But Hushai actually plays a very, very instrumental role, although it's hard to figure out exactly why, because there's a complicated description of two alternatives, right? In other words, Avshalom now faces the question, how do I rout David? How do I get David? How do I get rid of his army? How do I establish myself as undisputed monarch? So there are two proposals. Proposal number one is Achitophel's proposal. Achitophel's proposal is, essentially, to have a small surgical mission, we would use it in modern military parlance. Small, although it doesn't seem that small to me, 12,000 people. We will go, we will not try to inflict major casualties on the entire people that are with David. We will simply make our special attempt to kill David, and as a result, by minimizing our casualties, we will be able to get people's loyalty, and we will be able to kill the king. This is Achitofel, so we would call that surgical strike. Although again, I just don't understand the numbers because, I mean, David did not leave with a huge army. David left Ittai Hagiti, Ittai the Philistine from Gat, who became a loyalist, took 600 people. So you know, we really don't know how many other people gathered to David. But the one thing that's clear is Achitofel describes his plan as a narrowly tailored surgical strike designed to get rid of David and the hardcore loyalists without inflicting casualties on others that might cause animosity and hatred. Right? That is Achitofel's strategy. Avshalom figures, sounds good. But he then turns to Hushai Ho'erki and he says, what do you think? And Hushai says, not a good idea. And Hushai advances the concepts that, you know, David's men are bitter and they're hurting. And when somebody is hungry and bitter and hurting, hungry meaning, you know, really, they just, because of their situation, they're so displaced, they will fight like a dove shakul, interesting phrase. That means a bereaved bear. Right? You take away the cubs of a bear, the bear will fight with a ferocity and a ferociousness well out of proportion. A bear is pretty strong anyway, but well out of proportion even to the natural strength of the bear, right? Like an angry lion or a bear. And therefore, he basically says, you can't cut corners here. Don't think with your little surgical strikes you'll get David. And he reminds Avshalom, kind of maybe to scare Avshalom a little bit, your father is known as a great warrior. And therefore, he basically says, bring everybody out. In other words, this has to be a massive campaign with all of your people against all of his people. Now, Achitofel kind of overreacts here. Maybe it's not clear what's going on. Achitofel, on one level, seems to be so distraught that his advice is being ignored, because Avshalom decides to go with Achitofel, that Achitofel goes and commits suicide. He kills himself. Now, it's not clear what the significance of that is. One idea might just be that this is the first time in Achitofel's life that somebody didn't consider his advice. And maybe he's overreacting to the notion that somebody's idea was better. Now, this would not be advised for meetings or whatever. You know, one should not take such extreme action. The other interpretation is that Achitofel understood correctly as it stood, that if his advice was not followed and there would be a public confrontation of that magnitude, indeed he would lose. Avshalom would lose, and therefore Achitofel knows that his days are numbered because David is going to come back and David is not going to forgive him. Now maybe David would have forgiven, we don't know, but from Achitofel's perspective, this would have been such a disgrace for him that he killed himself first. Now, what's troubling to me is, though, that it's really not at all clear why is Hushai's plan so obviously inferior. In other words, why is Achitofel so sure that Hushai's plan is destined for failure? I mean, it could have worked because the point is this. The first thing that I thought was, well, maybe Achitofel's plan would have had the advantage of secrecy. And Hushai's plan would have alerted, because of the massive army, would have alerted. But that doesn't make sense to me, because it turns out that the runners, Achimoatz and Yonatan, were able to inform David of both plans. They basically said, this was Achitofel's plan, and this was Hushai's plan. So, the issue couldn't be one of secrecy, because the point was that they were able to inform David of both options. So even if they would have gone with Achitofel's plan, it wouldn't have been secret. David would have figured it out. So one thing that's not clear, maybe it's because of my lack of military understanding, is it's not so obviously intuitive to me why Achitofel has such an overwhelming sense that, although it happened to be so, that Hushai's plan was a setup that would in effect result in Avshalom's defeat. Well, I'm sure Achitofel did suspect that, but again, Yeah, but the point is this. See, what's not clear to me is Hushai's goal merely the discrediting of Achitofel, or is Hushai trying to devise a plan that will maximize David's chances of success? See, if the issue is, Hushai could have said anything. Hushai's goal is to simply discredit and embarrass Achitofel. You know, that could be accomplished. But what is hard for me to grasp a little bit is that apparently Hushai's intention is to come up with a plan that Avshalom will agree with, but in fact will increase David's chances of success. And I'm not clear why it does increase David's chances of success. It can't be because it will become more public, because David was aware of both plans. Hushai sent him a message, plan A and plan B. Yeah.
What was the one that David would lose his Achitofel?
That's exactly it. That's
so
exactly
maybe
it.
That happened,
yep.
And he felt this, and
right.
He realized that the divinity had left him.
Right.
And once that was gone, maybe that was one of the reasons.
Which means, in effect, so this is one way of approaching this. The merits of Hushai's plan are almost irrelevant, meaning to say, it's not that Hushai's plan is better or worse. The simple point is, it's not Achitofel's plan. In other words, the fact that Achitofel's advice was ignored was seen by Achitofel as a sign
and
that...
He also felt that, divine prophecy needs him, so he also...
Well, although it's not clear. I mean, he came up with an answer. It's not like Eviatar, who did not come up with an answer. Achitofel came up with something. It was just ignored and not listened to. So you don't really see the same leaving of the divine inspiration. Now, we already discussed, of course, that we discussed Shaul, whether Halacha recognizes suicides as legitimate or not legitimate. But suffice it to say, though, that killing yourself because your advice wasn't listened to is not legitimate. So in that sense, Achitofel's suicide is not considered a halachic precedent in any way. But it is a tragic end to a person who is apparently a very, very gifted, wise, perceptive person. I mean, the psukim, when they describe his role, have only the highest praise for him. They say his advice was like getting it straight from God, etc. And perhaps... I don't remember that. I don't think, does it say? Let's see, maybe I'm missing a pasuk. Are you thinking of Avshalom himself, or?
No.
Let's see.
Avshalom was David's first son, right?
No, not his first son.
Oh, that's why he wanted to be a king.
No, just, 1 second.
Who was his
Amnon was his first son.
23.
Yeah, what chapter? 20? Yeah, he was buried. Yeah, he was buried in the ancestral Kever Aviv. Yeah, this is 1723. The Yitzavel Beito, he gave a will, so this was a calm, premeditated act. Vayechonek, he strangled himself. Vayamat, he died. Vayikaver bekever Aviv, and he was buried in the grave of his father. That just means he was buried in the family plot. It doesn't connote unusual distinction, although it does indicate he was not disgraced in his burial. I just want to just quote you one statement that the Gemara makes. The Gemara says that, let me just find this here, Achitofel HaGiloni, Achitofel from Gilo, that's where he was from, Chacham, he was a wise person, V'haya Baal Torah, he was a master of the Torah, Ubishvil gasut haruach shahayabo, because of the arrogance and haughty spirits that he possessed, nakar min ha'olam hazeh, he was uprooted from this world, umin ha'olam haba, and from the world to come. So Chazal do identify the fatal flaw as gasut haruach, which is an arrogant spirit, a haughty spirit. Well, you never know. These are traditions. These are traditions that they had. You know, the Chachamim make many statements about who has Olam Haba, who doesn't. Yeah.
Well, a man isn't allowed to commit suicide and be buried in the Jewish area. So maybe the fact that he was buried with his father meant there was a forgiveness. You know, in other words, they...
Yeah, well, actually, I'll tell you the truth. If you read this literally, if you read verse 23 literally, you don't automatically know that there's a suicide. Translate every word in that verse. This is the universal assumption, but it doesn't really say that. It says, he saw that his advice was not followed. He saddled his donkey. He went to his house. Now, Yitzav al Beito seems to connote he gave some farewell message. Vayechonak is in the passive. He was strangled. It actually does not say he did something to himself. This could mean, yeah, it could mean, number one, that he choked on food, right? He did the Heimlich maneuver. It could mean that maybe somebody murdered him on some level. The word is very ambiguous. Now, the Yitzav el Beito, which literally means he commanded his house, theoretically does not have to connote a last will and testament, although I think in common biblical usage it does. So the pasuk is a little ambiguous. Are we dealing with an actual suicide? I assume the translations...
It says strangled himself.
So what, did they make that up?
No.
Well,
Vayechanak
is not a hitzpael. Vayechanak is a form of nifal. Nifal is a passive. Right? It could have, I don't know if there is such a usage, but if it would have said Vayitchanek would have meant he strangled himself. That is called Hitzpael. This is a Nifal. A Nifal just means it was done to him, but it doesn't automatically suggest that he did it to himself. Although, again, as I say, I think it's ambiguous. Maybe that's why he was buried bekever aviv. Maybe it was not clear. On the other hand, a lawyer would say we have suspicious circumstances. Why is he giving that his last will and testament to his children? Unless maybe he suspects someone's out to get him. Like the mafia.
Prophesizing it.
Maybe it's a prophecy, or the mafia comes and says, you can say your last words. Right? There are people there waiting for him when he gets home. Of course, who would be waiting for him? It's not clear there, too. I assume, to put David in a fairly good light, that these were not like people from David out to get him. That would have, because David prayed that his advice shouldn't be followed. Maybe it would be Hushai Arki, who is kind of an over-loyal friend to David, who wants to get rid of this Achitofel and the like. We don't know. It's very intriguing. But I'm noticing this for the first time, that a very, very literal reading does not automatically say it must have been a suicide. Although, as I say, I think the commentaries almost universally just make that assumption. Yeah?
If someone were to behave this way today, out of normal character, do such a thing, and the family is heartbroken and wants to do the burial, Rabbi, room to say this is an action?
Sure. That's right. I mean, although, the halakha on one hand says this rule, someone who commits suicide is not buried in the regular Jewish section of the ceremony, that does not apply if one acted out of extreme duress or pain or depression. And we then have a catch-22 that nobody would kill themselves unless they were acting under those circumstances. So in the majority of cases, we do in fact bury suicides in the regular part of the cemetery, and the family will even sit Shiva. In other words, this is almost kind of a self-destruction, destroying halakha, because we don't punish the person if he acted out of despair. People don't kill themselves unless they're in despair. Therefore, one killed themselves, we're not going to apply the punishment of one who kills himself precisely because of that. So I myself, as they say, I have officiated that, unfortunately, suicides and the like. And
you
do it.
It's much worse for them than killing themselves.
Oh, sure, sure.
So they need a lot more support.
Yeah, the family goes through a tremendous amount of questions and guilt. Sure.
What did we do?
Right. Yeah, that's very, very true.
Maybe he had someone do the job, one of his servants.
Well, maybe so, but even so, you don't see it from the grammatical word, because v'yechanak just means someone else could have done it to him. Okay, Be it as it may, Yoav has two more acts of violence. He's already kind of, gotten David irritated a number of times. Avshalom has a general, right? David, of course, has General Yoav, who's his nephew. And Avshalom gets another general, Amasa. Now, again, I don't want to overburden you with too many names. Suffice it to say, if you trace all of the complicated lineage in these passages, Amasa, it's kind of very incestuous a little bit. Amasa is Ayin, Mem, Sin, Aleph. Amasa is another cousin of Yoav. In other words, Amasa comes too from a daughter of Yisha. So you have David, and then you have David is the son of Yishai. Tsuruya is a sister of David, and Tsuruya had three sons, one of whom got killed in the beginning of Shmuel Bet, but the two surviving sons are Yoav, who is David's general, and Avishai, who is a subordinate. And then there's another sister of David, Avigal, not to be confused with Avigayo. Avigayo is David's wife. Avigal is David's sister, and this sister married somebody whose name was Yeser, or Yisra, HaYisraeli, true Israelite, which you get the title Yisraeli, and their son was Amasa. Okay, so if you get this lineage, therefore, Amasa and Yoav are cousins, and of course they're all both cousins to Avshalom, and Amasa is the general of Avshalom's troops, etc. But when Avshalom's troops are defeated, and Amasa goes over to David to effect a surrender, Yoav, through some type of ruse, kills him in an act of friendship. Mm-hmm. Again, let me just remind you that this is the second time that Yoav did exactly the same thing. In the beginning of the book, when Avner ben Ner, who was Shaul's general, wanted to make peace with David, Yoav killed him. And now when Amasa, after Avshalom's defeat, wants to reconcile, Yoav kills his own cousin again. And in fact, of course he also kills Avshalom, but in fact, just to connect this to Kings 1, the indictment of Yoav, which results in his death in the days of Shlomo, is for the murder of Avner ben Ner, 40 years ago, and Amasa ben Yetzer. Okay, so now you should be aware of what's going on. And obviously, Yoav also killed Avshalom. But what's interesting is, David does not, as grieving as David is, David does not hold Yoav accountable for that, because Avshalom apparently died in a state of war and aggression and made no overture of peace or surrender, as opposed to the other two. And obviously what's going on here is that Yoav is extremely afraid that these people will be rivals that will take over his position and influence. Avner was a general who was older than Yoav with enormous authority, and Amasa is a contemporary, but still, Yoav doesn't want anyone else around to be a rival. But that was a bad move, as we will say, because in fact, those were the two murders for which Yoav was sentenced on David's deathbed. Then, of course, we have the very famous scene of Avshalom, who had long, luxurious hair. This has been memorialized in some famous biblical paintings of Avshalom riding on a donkey. The hair gets tangled in the branches, and the donkey, keeps up going, and Avshalom is hanging by his hair. Very strong hair to be able to hang by it. And Yoav, a soldier tells Yoav this, and Yoav says, go finish him off. And the soldier basically says, this is the king's son. The king gave orders, right? The king said, be gentle with the lad, with the boy. And Yoav really just says, you could have done this. You could have gotten some good reward. I'll finish him off. He throws three arrows into Avshalom. And then apparently he didn't kill him yet, because then he told his other soldiers to beat him. One gets the impression from the pasuk, although it's not very clear, that Avshalom was actually beaten to death. It's not very clear, because the pasuk does not indicate, right after Yoav, let me find the verse there. Look in chapter 18, verse 14. Vayomer Yoav, Lo chen ochila lefanecha, meaning I'm not going to beg you. Meaning he's telling the person that I'm giving you an opportunity to do a mission. You don't want, I'll do it myself. Ikach shlosha shvatim b'chapo. He takes three spears in his hands. Vayitka'em b'lev Avshalom. He pierces the heart of Avshalom. Odenu chai b'lev ho'elah, who is still alive, hanging from the trunk of the tree. Elah is an oak tree. Vayasobu asara na'arim nosei klei Yoav. And then 10 youths who were carrying the arms of Yoav, v'yaku et Avshalom, they smit Avshalom, v'yemisuhu, and he dies.
So who killed him?
Well, it doesn't say Yoav killed him. Obviously, if the arrows pierced his heart, he was going to die. But it was finished off by a beating of 10 other people. Right. So apparently Avshalom died died a painful death of people beating him. That's the impression you get. Although again, the word vayakeu is a nice ambiguous word. Smote or beat. Now, smote might just mean they all shot him, but vayaku can also mean beating somebody to death. And basically they go back to, now here it's interesting, there's a little bit of a rivalry. Apparently, Yoav had conveyed the message to people that this was a great joy. Avshalom is dead. The king is now safe. And therefore, there apparently is some competition. Who gets to tell David the good news? So Achimaatz, who is the son of Tzadok, very much wants to give David the great news. And Yoav kind of has an idea that David's not going to be too happy about this. And he tells Achimaatz, you know, Achimaatz, maybe you shouldn't. Literally a dark-skinned person. And once again, you see a little bit of what you might regard as a racism, meaning if David's going to get mad, you know, let him get mad at him, not at you. And nevertheless, Achimaatz is so convinced that this would be great news that he overtakes the Cushi, meaning to say the Cushi gets sent out to be the messenger. Achimaatz runs, bypasses the Cushi. But apparently, at the last minute, see, it's a very strange story. Achimaatz gives David news of the victory, and then David then says, what about Avshalom? And apparently Achimaatz doesn't want to say. So the whole thing is very strange. On one hand, Yoav told Achimaatz, don't go, the king is going to be upset. Achimaatz insists on going. He overtakes the Cushi. And when he gets there and David says, what about Avshalom? All of a sudden, Achimaatz says, well, you know, I left the scene of the battle a little early, and I don't really know. There was a lot of hubbub. Now, apparently, just to visualize this, what happened was the intonation of David's voice, what happened to Avshalom, told Achimaatz. In other words, he came in with a different attitude than he realized. He realized he should not be the one. And then the Cushi, who is kind of a simpleton, he doesn't really suspect all the complications here, comes and David says, what happened to Avshalom? And the Cushi says, may what happened to him happen to all the enemies of the king. He died as he should have died, and he will no longer afflict you. Thinking once again that he will, he's doing the king a favor. Now the king does not, in fact, the king does not do anything to the messenger. The king does not hurt the messenger in any way. But we have the very immortal words in chapter 19. William Faulkner used the words for his novel, Absalom, Absalom, and he cried, and so he said, B'ni Avshalom, my son Absalom, B'ni, B'ni Avshalom, my son Avshalom, Mi yitein muti ani tachtecha. If only I could have died instead of you, Avshalom, B'ni, B'ni. And
where the empty words?
Well,
they fought him.
Who fought him? I mean, David was under attack. David did not start any war of aggression against Avshalom. Now it's pointed out that this is the third eulogy that David gives in the book of Shmuel. The first eulogy is upon the death of Shaul and Yonatan, which is the very, very eloquent but short eulogy. They are beautiful and pleasant in their lives. Uvamotam lo nifradu, and even in death they were not separated. Minisharim kalu, they are swifter than the eagles. Mearayot gaveru, they are mightier than the lions. That was his eulogy for Shaul and Yonatan. Then he gave more of a pro forma eulogy for Avner ben Ner, which probably may not have been motivated out of love and affection, but out of political necessity, because, you know, Avner was the leading general of Shaul that was coming over. He gets killed. This could devastate David's credibility in reaching out to his enemies. So he gave a little eulogy for Avner ben Ner, saying that, Avner, you were a mighty man, and you should not have died like a despicable person. And the third eulogy, which is the most inarticulate of all, without any trace of poetry, but reflective totally of the pain of a human heart, is the eulogy for Avshalom. It's not really a eulogy. He's not addressing it to anybody. This is the silence, it's audible, but the cry that is coming when he's by himself, and that represents a level of sadness that is so profound that it cannot be expressed in any particular words. You just say the same thing over and over again. And in fact, there's a whole bunch of things that David is crying about. You have to understand that he's not just crying because Avshalom is dead, but he's crying over this process that resulted in such estrangement, in such separation, in such lost opportunities, that there'll never be a chance to make up. There'll never be a chance to come together. See, it's not just the death. It is the whole thing. The whole thing. He was my son. And Chazal say very beautifully that, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. We're supposed to get, does Rashi say? Rashi says 8. There are 8 expressions here. Bini Avshalom is 2. Bini is 4. Avshalom is 5. Avshalom bini. There are 8 expressions of grief. And Rashi brings a tradition that with David's grief and prayers, there are supposed to be 7 chambers of hell, or Gehenna. He brought Avshalom up. Avshalom was in the deepest chamber. He brought him up with 7 chambers. And the 8th was he got him into Olam Haba. In fact, that's the concept of the grief that a family feels, and they turn to God for that comfort, can actually help the deceased reach higher levels. I think I had mentioned that, although it is not recorded, that Avshalom is buried in the plot that he made for himself, but we have the memorial in the Kidron Valley that it is recorded. As I say, archaeologists say that the particular monument we have dates from the Crusader era, but the Crusaders identified that it was Yad Avshalom. Avshalom made a memorial for himself at a time when he had no children. And as I mentioned, that there were great rabbis who would actually pray at Yad Avshalom, because they would ask God, that God, if a father can love this son so much, then can you also look at us in spite of our shortcomings and forgive us? So what then happens is the king, there was a great victory. I mean, imagine this. This great threat against the king was crushed. But the king is mourning and grieving and crying. And there's an interesting phrase, how the crowds came. But verse 4, this is chapter 19, verse 4. Vayitganev ha'am bayomu. Vayitganev is an interesting word. The shoresh is ganav, steal. Kitpael is when you do it to yourself. You steal yourself away. That means you come there for a great joy. And you see there's no joy here. The people are so embarrassed to be there. The king is kind of acting strange. And they just walk, they just like sneak away silently. And they're very, very humiliated and embarrassed. And they don't know what to feel. Should they feel happy today? Or should they feel sad? No, the king is kind of creating the tone here. And what exactly is the tone? And was Avshalom such a great, love of David? And the king keeps on crying again. B'ni Avshalom. Now it's louder. Apparently people hear him crying. B'ni Avshalom, Avshalom, B'ni, B'ni. So Yoav comes in with some very tough talk. Yoav comes to the king and says, you have humiliated all of these soldiers that have given their life for you. And you don't even express your gratitude. And he said to him, and what have you done? You have loved your enemies, which might be a nice ideal, but you have hated those that love you. And you are basically saying that if Avshalom were to live and all of us would die, you would be much happier. Very, very sharp words. He's basically saying, yeah, you would have been happy had it been the other way around. That we would have lost, we would have been killed. As long as your son Avshalom is there, Avshalom was the one that hated you. And he's the one that you love. And you don't care about all the people who are loyal. And look at this, he gives David an order. Look at verse 8. V'ata, and now, come, get up. Say, three imperatives, one after the other. Say, get up, get out, daber, speak, words of encouragement. Now you'll notice, if you remember, there was a certain unctuousness in the way David was normally addressed. Remember the woman of Tekoa, and even Yoav sometimes would say, if the king please, if you know God gives the king, you know, wisdom and a certain politeness and excessive language, this speech is totally absent. Yoav is not providing empathy. He's not providing compassion. He's not saying, "I know it's tough, but we have a duty." He's basically telling David, "Who do you think you are? And what nerve you have not to be grateful to people who saved your life? Get up, get out, and speak words of encouragement." Right? Very, very different tone. Yeah.
Now, I hadn't noticed before, but it's kind of mentioned the possibility of that this Avshalom was kind of empty.
Right.
And in a way, you know, the reaction to David is, stop your melodramatic.
Right.
We all died for you.
Right.
You know, he's reacting to it the same way. And in fact, if David had really thought that, he could have welcomed Avshalom into Jerusalem and crowned him. If he really would have rather die than have his son die, he didn't have to oppose his desire to be a monarch.
Well, you know, the thing is this. The thing is that David did give an order. I mean, David did not want to abdicate. I think that's very, very clear. Otherwise, he could have abdicated.
Right.
David did not want to abdicate, but David did not hope, at least according to David, that Avshalom would be dead.
Right.
Presumably, the concept was he would be captured and whatever it is. In fact, he gave the order to Yoav, do not touch the youth Avshalom.
Right.
So this is really after the fact. I don't think we can infer from his failure to abdicate a lack of concern for his son, given the fact that he gave an order. Now, you could always say, knowing Yoav, shouldn't David have realized that his order, well, you know, who knows? But you know, these are all possibilities. Now, one of the interesting features about learning Tanakh is that you always have to ask yourself, do you take a person's professions at face value, or is there some indication, indeed, perhaps it is not as sincere as it might have been? I think that all of us on a human level, you know, can identify with this kind of ambivalence in which, you know, Avshalom, when he was alive, may have been this evil thing that would have been better off to be eliminated, but particularly if you look at the grieving as the grieving of the whole process, you know, where was this, you know, cute five-year-old, whatever it was. I mean, Avshalom, at some point in his life, you know, was probably an adorable, right? In Musar Svarim, we sometimes have, how do you deal with difficult people? So one of the... No, just what you said. Yeah, sorry. That's correct. And David is now reverting to father. That's right. I was going to say that one of the advices that ethical books give us to deal with difficult people is try to visualize them as cute children. Because at some point they probably were cute, right? And kind of look at them in that light. And the mourning over the process. Now again, Yoav is basically saying life has to go on. He's being very tough here. Now Yoav, we see, is a tough character. Now you could be very critical of him there. I mean, you know, he kills Avner, okay. He kills Amasa, that happens to be his cousin, although there's no particular mention. And by the way, David does not even eulogize Amasa, because David is overwhelmed with Avshalom, but don't forget the Book of Kings. Yoav's killing of Amasa was treated as a very, very severe offense. David remembers that, notes that, and points that out on his deathbed. But Yoav kills his own cousin. Yoav is ruthless in eliminating any rivals to power. Yeah.
Is there a sense of the loyalty of the common person between David and his son, and where the loyalty was?
It is hard to say. Obviously, it must have been a fairly equal divide, because if it was not, if the common people were overwhelmingly with David, it's hard to know why David would have had to flee Jerusalem. It may even be that the majority went with Avshalom, maybe out of fear, if nothing else.
But now Yoav is also warning David that if you don't say something to the people now, they're going to leave you.
Well, that's what he says. He says, I'm swearing to you today that if you don't go out, nobody will stay with you. Now, where they're going to go, we don't know, but Yoav will devise something. But again, the harshness, and he says, and what will happen to you will be worse than anything that happened to you from your youngest days until now. And Yoav is very familiar with David's biography, including the pursuit by Shaul, and he's saying, you ain't seen nothing yet. Things are going to be a lot worse. So this is a very, very unusually aggressive and demanding way of talking to the king, but the king meekly obeys without a protest. He's kind of on mechanical, automatic pilots. Sometimes, now again, one might even argue, you know, who knows? Although, I mean, Avshalom hasn't even been buried yet, necessarily. Well, he's been buried, but we don't know exactly. This is presumably the day that he was killed. But there is a concept sometimes that you've got to go on automatic pilot, and you've got to put one foot in front of the other foot, particularly when we have king versus father, as was pointed out. And he goes out. He goes out. And lo and behold, people are waiting with a hush. And the king comes out, and they're waiting to see what the king is going to do, etc. And we are given no particular words there. He just goes out. In other words, what does he do? He goes out. He shows himself. That's as much as he can do. And that's something that gives people some encouragement. He acknowledges their role. He, in effect, is thanking them for their sacrifice. But there's no rousing speech here. There's no particular words that he's saying. Now, again, does that mean he didn't say anything? We don't know. But apparently, omissions are significant. The fact that there is no record of what he says indicates he didn't say anything particularly memorable or impressive, simply because he was too broken up inside to be able to say anything. Okay. Now, remember where David is, by the way. Just remember, you have to keep a bit of the geography here. David is actually east, the east bank of the Jordan River, at a place Machanayim. David is not in Jerusalem yet. Avshalom has been defeated, but David is still in his exile place. And now David is going to make his triumphant return to Jerusalem. And it's a curious message. He sends a message, and it's funny how every little excuse could be used to start a civil war here. He sends a message to the B'nai Yehuda, and he says, you know, and apparently they have not followed him, you know, I'm coming back to Jerusalem, and I have a lot of people from other tribes who are going to escort me, but why should you guys be the last? I'll give you the opportunity to come first and have the honor of being in the royal entourage. Now, apparently, when the B'nai Yehuda showed up, this in itself created some animosity because they were the Johnny-come-latelys. Ironically, David, see again, if you're a Yehuda person, you're not really sure who to follow, David or Avshalom, because they're both the same line. And apparently, there is this fellow once again. There are two things that happened. So David is coming back. Okay, just not get the scene in your mind. David sends a message to the B'nai Yehuda to escort him. We don't know how many. The B'nai Yehuda crossed the Jordan to escort him. And now we have all sorts of people making apologies. We have Shimi ben Gera. Again, I apologize for the names, but the names keep on popping up. Shimi ben Gera was a Binyaminite. And if you recall, when David was leaving Jerusalem, Shimi ben Gera threw rocks at David and threw dirt at him and cursed him and said, God is now punishing you, not for Bathsheba. God is punishing you because you took the Malchut away from Shaul, And of course, Yoav wanted to finish Shimi ben Gera off right then. And David's attitude was one of passive acquiescence. If God wants me to be humiliated, I accept it. Although, make a note that Shimi ben Gera is put on the enemy's list to be dealt with later. But at this point, David was not going to do anything. Now, Shimi ben Gera actually comes and apologizes. Right? So by the way, I mentioned that Shimi ben Gera was an ancestor of Mordechai of the Purim story. It says Mordechai ben Yair ben Shimi. That ben Shimi is skipping a lot of generations. And he's the son of Shimi ben Gera. And in fact, that is why people would criticize David in retrospect. And they say, if David just would have taken care of Shimi ben Gera, there never would have been a Mordechai that would have gotten us in trouble by his refusal to bow down. That's why Mordechai is described as Ish Yemini, a man from Benjamin, the Ish Yehudi, and a man from Judah. Which tribe was he from? Genealogically, he was from Binyamin. However, people would cast aspersions on the tribe of Yehuda by saying, if your ancestor David from Yehuda would have finished off Shimi ben Gera, there never would have been a Mordechai to give us trouble. So it's like, you know, when parents are fighting, your son, my son, right? If he behaves bad, take care of your son. So people said to Yehuda, he's your man. And of course, the people of Yehuda finger-pointed at Binyamin and said, he's your man, because he comes from Shimi ben Gera. When Mordechai was successful, of course, it was the opposite. The people of Yehuda claimed him as Yehuda, you see, because our ancestors spared him. And the people of Binyamin said he comes from Binyamin. But be it as it may, Shimi ben Gera now comes and begs. That's correct. That's correct. He bows down and he apologizes, etc. And he says, please, please forgive me. And of course, Avishai, Yoav's brother, once again says, shouldn't I kill him anyway? And David basically says, not today. Of course, not today. Now we have to say that Shimi, now again, that's why the beginning of Kings, and maybe we'll look at that, you know, because the beginning of Kings is very, very important, because it's very, very hard to understand, and I'll admit that right off the bat, because on one hand, we have this David, you know, forgiving, you know, he forgives Shimi ben Gera. We have David forgiving various people that we see, and yet he forgives them for the day, but he has a long memory, and he leaves it to his son to finish them off. In fact, it's very interesting the way Shimi ben Gera gets killed, just to go a little bit ahead. He basically says to Shlomo, this is David's deathbed instruction, don't kill Shimi ben Gera directly, but put him under house arrest, city arrest, really. And if he ever violates the terms of his arrest, he could then be killed. So Shlomo simply told Shimi, never leave Jerusalem again. You're confined to Jerusalem. And the story goes, he went out to look for some donkeys, like Shaul, and he got caught, and he was killed. So Rav Chaim Shmulevitz, I mentioned last week, I think it's the second time I mentioned him, the great Rosh Yeshiva, once commented, what type of fool, I mean, if you're told, I mean, it's not like house arrest, it's not like you're limited to a, you know, a 4x6 jail cell. The city of Jerusalem, of course, it was probably smaller than it is today, you didn't have all of West Jerusalem, but if a person is told, stay in the city, and if you leave the city, you're going to be killed, why would a person risk his life to retrieve a donkey? He could have gotten somebody to look for it. I mean, and as Chaim Levitz mentioned, he knows many people who spend their whole life in Jerusalem. They never leave. Right? Why do you want to leave Jerusalem anyway? And as Chaim Shmulevitz said, the answer is, until he was told he couldn't leave, perhaps he never would have bothered to leave. But when a human being is told, you may not leave, we are immediately seized with an unbelievable sense of confinement. Right? That is the nature. And it became so unbearable that he figured, well, you know, maybe just once I'll sneak out and they won't catch me. Of course, not knowing that he was under surveillance. So, Rav Chaim Shmulevitz has pointed out, this is how unwilling a human being is to submit to authority. Many things we would be gladly do once we're told to do that. A child as well. There's a certain, husband as well, there's a certain rebelliousness in the person. If you're telling me to do it, I'm not going to do it. I would have done it, you know, but not if you tell me to do it. Right? So that's kind of human, nature, which you see from the Shimi Ben Gera story. But again, as I indicate, David is very forgiving today, And he tells V'yomer HaMelech El Shemi, Lo Tamut, you shall not die, V'yishav Alo HaMelech, and the king swears. But once again, as I say, there's apparently a mental reservation in this particular oath. So Shimi ben Gera comes, Mephibosheth comes. Again, the names keep on adding up here, but again, everyone should know who Mephibosheth is. Mephibosheth was the surviving son of Yonatan. Mephibosheth had been dropped as a child or as a baby, and as a result, he was lame. They didn't really have superior prosthetic devices or orthopedic surgery in those days, so if you kind of got dropped, you were in a permanent situation. It could very well be, although there is a teaching that has the other interpretation, that from his mouth there was Boshet to David. He was David's teacher in Torah. He was so superior to David in Torah learning that David was embarrassed.
Oh.
It's treated as a complimentary term. But now if you remember, Siva, who was this kind of conniving slave of Mephibosheth, with a large family and a lot of slaves of his own, he was the one who came to David when David's running away and brought David a lot of things. And David said, where is Mephibosheth, your master? And Siva said, Mephibosheth became an Avshalom loyalist. And as a result, David decreed that all of Mephibosheth's property is forfeited to Siva. But now Mephibosheth shows up in mourning, dirt on his hair, ripped clothing, and says, you know, and David says, why didn't you come with me? And he said, well, I told Siva to saddle up the donkeys, and Siva left without me, and I couldn't get there myself. And we have a curious thing. In other words, apparently, David is discovering for the first time that Siva's accusation against Mephibosheth is invalid. But what does he do? He then splits the property. He says, your property will be split. Now, again, it's a difficult sequence. David had taken all of Mephibosheth's property. He had given it to Siva. And now that Siva is found to be lying, he simply lets Siva keep 50% of it. What is the logic of that? So there are two possibilities. One is David is not sure who's telling the truth. Maybe Yonatan, maybe Mephibosheth is doing this after the fact. Right. So as a result, right, when you have mammon, monetary issues that are in doubt among two claimants, we split the property in two. That's one interpretation, meaning David simply says, I don't know who to believe here. The other interpretation, I think, is a bit harsher, but it's also possible. Maybe David's attitude is, you know, I don't care how you were supposed to get there, you should have been there. In other words, David's basically saying, okay, you know, take the bus. In other words, the concept is, David is kind of intimating to Mephibosheth that your loyalty to me must be important enough that even if your servant, you know, took all the donkeys, you find a way to get here. So you're not disloyal per se, but, you know, you'll lose something in the deal. That's a little bit harsh, I think, but that might be a possibility as well. And then, of course, there's yet another person, Barzillai HaGiladi. Barzillai is his name. Giladi is from Gilad. Gilad is the area East Jordan. If you remember, Barzillai had offered David also hospitality when David was transjordan. Barzillai was an older man. David wanted to support him in Jerusalem. And Barzillai basically says, I don't want to go. He says, I'm already 80 years old. If you give me fancy food, I really don't know what it tastes like, etc. Actually, Chazal basically kind of have a strong comment, which is interesting in this day of youthful elderly. He says that, you know, 80's not so old. Why Barzillai is talking like he's 120 years old. He says, Barzillai had lived a very dissolute lifestyle. He had been involved in a lot of improper sexual liaisons, and as a result, he was prematurely aged. Therefore, Chazal indicate that if one lives a good life, then God will often allow the good health. Well, David may have been more naturally vigorous, so he could take some.
That's the invigoration. Yeah.
Well, it depends. You know, within limits. But anyway, Barzillai basically makes the point that I don't hear that well. I can't hear the beautiful male singers and female singers. Remember, it's Sharim, not Sarim. Right? Sharim v'Sharot. And he makes the point that people often say that I want to live in the home that I was born, in the city that I was born, In fact, you often find people where it's possible. It's not really so possible in the United States, where there's a great mobility, but in Europe, where often a home remains in a family, there is a sentiment a person would like to die in the home or sometimes in the bed that they were born. There's a certain closure. And Barzilai expresses that idea that I want to die in the place that I was born. I want to be buried next to my father and my mother. I don't need some fancy life in Yerushalayim. But he says, you can take my son, give my son all of those things. And indeed, David does offer that type of hospitality to Barzilai's son, who must also have been a mature adult at this time. Yeah.
But why does David feel David needed
Barzilai? He didn't really need Barzilai, but he figured that he wanted to, because Barzilai's kindness to him, and Barzilai was infirm and not that healthy, so he said, I will support you at the royal table. Just like Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth, too.
And I was just going to say, unlike...
Who was a Torah teacher, even. Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. Although in the text, that's not indicated that Mephibosheth was a Torah teacher. But the simple meaning is that one of the ways that David repays hospitality is by supporting people at the royal table. That was considered to be a great honor and homage. But Barzilai declined it. But again, let me just remind you, on his deathbed, David is very cognizant in the Book of Kings about the chesed of Barzilai, and he does make the point that Barzilai should be taken care of well after David's death. That's why I was saying, if you read the first chapter of Kings and you would not be aware of these concluding chapters, the names wouldn't make sense. There's the Shimi ben Gera, Barzilai HaGiladi, right? You wouldn't know who any of these people are. That's why Eliyahu is called Eliyahu HaGiladi. Remember, Gilad is simply the name of the Transjordan area that was given to the tribes of Reuven and Gad. Now, the half-tribe of Manasseh had the Bashan, had the Golan Heights. That's a little further north. But the plain along the riverbank is called Gilad.
I'd like to regress on a pasuk back earlier, and it has to do with two thoughts that to me come together. You talk about that we should see people when they were young, and therefore we would have a greater kindness and compassion if they grow up with failures and foibles.
Right.
Yet none of the Nach talks about children and how they are treated, except perhaps Eli, by his mother, loved and taking care of and spending time with them. Yet when there's one pasuk back in Shmuel days where Shlomo was born, we say no one's born with a silver spoon. Yet it says specifically that Hashem loved him. And that's one pasuk that we seem not to have gone over.
I think
that's a very valuable pasuk.
Right.
Hashem does not love anybody else the way it says very specifically that Hashem loved him. I mean, he already has a thousand points.
A sense of grace, a sense of...
So obviously he must have been also a very unusual child.
Well, you know, it's interesting. One could write about this. There are books written about this. What was the conception of children in antiquity and even in the Middle Ages? You know, we look at children, and even as separate human beings, not as miniature adults, but as, you know, in a separate world with separate ideas, separate emotions.
In those days,
children were sometimes perceived of as a sense of property. It's a different view. In fact, what's fascinating is, in the book of Job, this is a very disturbing passage for many people. You know, Job loses all of his kids, and then it says at the end, you know, when everything is good and well, and God gave him, you know, another, double the number that he had before. As if to say, you know, you lose a pound of wheat, we'll give you 5 pounds, and everything's the same. Which doesn't recognize the child as unique and irreplaceable. Now, you see already that this bothered even the medieval commentators, because Nachmanides goes out of his way to say, well, God gave him back the same kid. Nachmanides has a whole theory that Job's kids never died. They were just taken to a cave and hidden. And at the end of the story, they were returned. But why is the Ramban twisting it that way? The answer must be, I think, is the Ramban already understood, hey, you can't replace a child with a child. Even cloning, which is the closest thing, parents sometimes think that that would be the same, but it would not be the same. The experiences are different. It would not really be the same. It's not the same child.
Thank you.
So, you know, there is that issue, what you're raising. What were children perceived of as separate and distinct? Were they a form of property? In fact, Chazal even sometimes mentioned that the reason why a partner, I mean, let's assume that a man and a woman get married. So the basic assumption of halakha is, in the absence of health reasons, either one has the right to say, let's try to have children. And if that doesn't work out, you know, they could divorce. But, you know, children is a right in a marriage, if it's possible, in the absence of health reasons. And the reason that's given, though, is not so much, you know, the emotional feelings that we would give, but it's so you will have somebody to take care of you in your old age. Mm-hmm. And, of course, in many cultures, even in the world today, the concept that a child had a responsibility to take care of.
That was a retirement plan.
It was a retirement plan. That's correct. That is very correct. And, of course, today we have the Yiddish situation of one mother takes care of 10 children, then some can't take care of one mother. But in the ideal situation, again, I don't mean to address the issue of nursing homes and like, because sometimes there's no question that these are indispensable places. I'm not at all criticizing anyone. But in the ideal world, I think we would all agree that if one is able to provide care for a child to take care of a parent, is the ideal way of reciprocity for what happened for so many years in the opposite situation. So there are actually books about the perception of the child in the ancient world. And your point is that in that sense, maybe Shlomo was unique in that sense. Yeah.
If Hashem loved all of us, in other words, we were born under Hashem's specific statement, right. I love you, or yeah. You are a special child, we would all be Shlomo. But isn't that the point?
Well,
in other words,
we're
not born equal.
I'm not sure, you know, see, you're reading this verse as if to say, you know, God loved Shlomo, but he doesn't love, you know, Abraham or other people.
I think it is a strong statement,
but I think what it's suggesting might be understood from the perspective of the observer. In other words, you see this child. I mean, unfortunately, it's the way we are. You know, we sometimes see a child and we say, what a special child. And we just have that feeling. And we look at another child, sometimes our own, and we say, oh, no, it's not so special. And that's a sad thing. You know, that's a sad thing. And I think it's not that God intrinsically loves one more than the other. But I think the pasuk is emphasizing that Shlomo had a certain aura about him that when you looked at him, you said, this is a favored child of God. But it's not necessarily saying that it's not true for other children, but you didn't notice it as much. It wasn't as apparent.
Isn't that strange? That's sort of
it is very strange. That's correct. Keep in mind, and maybe we'll talk about this later, because I want to elaborate on this some more. Keep in mind, therefore, that Mashiach comes from the union of David and Bathsheba, because Mashiach comes from Shlomo. And of course, keep in mind that this is merely another in the long history of improper sexual liaisons that culminate in Mashiach. Ruth comes from Ammon and Moab, who had incest with Lot. Yehuda and Tamar, etc., David and Bathsheba, right? So this whole concept of, the Zohar makes a big point of this, well, maybe we'll save it for the next session, but the Zohar makes a very big point about the sexual immorality as somehow being a precursor to Messianic redemption, which has been interpreted by deviant movements like Shaftai Tzvi in an overly literal way. but indeed, in any deviant movement, there are, you know, certain ideas which are truth that are then perverted. So we'll try to talk about what that meaning would be. But it's very, very clear that having Mashiach come from David and Bathsheba is consistent with having Mashiach be descended from Ruth and from Yehuda and Tamar. That's right. Yeah.
It's also a relation for me. The only place in the Torah, in the Eschanan, where Hashem uses only one that he loves
the Jewish nation.
Yeah.
I took you out because I loved you. In other words, yeah. regardless of what you might have done,
right.
there was a great love that I had for
right.
Israel.
Right. It's not the only place, though. There are a few more places. There aren't that many places. No, it is true. You know, we, in our generation, which is a softer generation, and we sometimes have to combat, you know, missionary arguments that, you know, Christianity is love and Judaism isn't. So we emphasize very much the concept of God loving us. And that is very true. The Torah does say God loves us. God is like our father. We are the children of God. It certainly says that legend. But we do have to be honest and say that that is not a repeated emphasis in the Torah. The Torah does speak much about reverence, about awe, about fear, although you could always translate fear to mean reverence and awe. It doesn't have to be fear in that sense. So it is true that Judaism does emphasize, as does the sources of Christianity as well, although they get downplayed, does emphasize this dual relationship of love coupled with reverence, fear, and limits. As I say, in our softer generation, we tend to push the more comfortable aspects of being a Jew, but we have to recognize there is that other. In fact, even in a bracha, even in a small formulation, as the grammatical structure of a bracha, I think I may have pointed this out before, a bracha abruptly shifts from second person to third person. You make a bracha on water. Baruch atah, blessed art you, God. Shahakol niya bidvaro, everything came in through his word. It should say, Shahakol niya bidvarecha. So the commentaries explain that in Hebrew, the second person is called nochach. You are speaking directly to somebody, you. The third person, he, or who, is nistar. The person is not there. This connotes the idea that in relating to God, we have two different levels. We have what is called immanence, the feeling of an intimate, close, loving camaraderie and friendship with the Almighty, which is expressed in the Atah, you are right here with me. But then there is also the transcendence of God being inaccessible to human understanding, over and above us, something that is not physical, something that is all-powerful, omnipotent, omniscient, and that is manifested in the switch between the immediate and familiar, which is the second person, and the transcendence and beyond comprehension, which is the third person. And that, of course, corresponds to the two methods of serving God, where we say serve God out of love, and serve Ava, and serve God out of Yira. Right? The Yira focuses on God's transcendence. The Ahava focuses on God's immediacy. Right? So that's a very important idea. You need both, because if God is simply your buddy, you know, you don't have the proper respect and reverence in serving him. Now, Yirah in itself can be further subdivided, and the philosophers of the Middle Ages make a very important distinction. There is what is called a primitive Yirah, which is still a level, and there is a higher Yirah. The primitive Yirah is simply fear of punishment. I better behave, or God is going to zap me one way or the other. There's a higher Yirah, which is Yirah of awe, reverence, and respect, right? Not punishment only, but a sense of, I will not behave a certain way because I have a sense of awe and respect for the Almighty. So one is called Yirat HaOnesh, fear of punishment. The other is Yirat Shemayim or Yirat HaRomamut, that is fear of the exalted nature of the Almighty. So the love and the fear, so it's a good point. We tend to emphasize, as I say, the softer parts of the religion without always being aware of the demands. Yeah.
There is a real conflict here, ever since I was a kid, the father. If you're great, the chosen people, and you're special,
yeah.
How come the Jews never kept Jerusalem, the Holocaust, and all of these things?
Well, these are the unanswered questions. Listen, indeed, you remember, Moshe asked God, why do the righteous people suffer? God said, I'm not telling you. You know, the book of Job is about that. I'm not purporting to answer all of these questions. I will say that, you know, God does indicate in the Torah that the Jewish people will undergo many sufferings in the course of their existence. Why that's so? Well, in a theoretical sense, although this does not satisfy people in particular, all punishments of God is sent to direct us in better paths. In other words, it is directed and guided as opposed to vengeful and vindictive. What do they say? Does that explain that? Does that explain the Holocaust? No. There are all sorts of mystical ideas that we talk about, including reincarnation. Rav Avi Yosef, the former Sephardic chief rabbi, got into deep, deep trouble in Israel on this one. But of course, you have to know a little bit that every secular reporter in Israel is out to get Rav Avi Yosef. So, whatever he says at any time, and maybe he should be aware of that more. Maybe there's a mistake in terms of not paying attention to his public relations. But they often wildly exaggerate little things that he says as an aside and turn it into a front page story. He had made a statement in the middle of a shiur about something else, so this was like something just in the middle, that those who died in the Holocaust were the reincarnations of Jews of past lives who had done many aveirot. Now, you understand how hurtful this was to many, many people, blaming the victim and the like. Well, okay, now, the point is this. Although reincarnation is not an article of faith, the Talmud, the Torah does not indicate it, etc., but certainly in Kabbalistic literature there is a concept of reincarnation, and one of the possibilities, nobody could say anything definite, one of the possibilities, listen, the Buddhists have the same, not as a proof, the Buddhists have the same idea that the source of evil and suffering in the world is the imperfect lives that were lived in prior reincarnations. There is such a concept. This is one of the answers classical religions of all types have come up with an answer to address the issue of the suffering of the innocent. I mean, this is a classical answer. Now, who knows if it's correct? Nobody knows. But it is an answer. Now, the second point to keep in mind is that this in no way exonerates, justifies, or tolerates the perpetration of evil on somebody else. Now, this is in the Chumash itself. See this in the Chumash. God tells Abraham, your children will be enslaved in a land that is not theirs. God says they'll be slaves, but God says, but the nation that enslaves them will be held to account. Meaning, there is never a concept, like saying, if I kill somebody, why don't you say the following? Nobody could die unless God willed it. Therefore, if I killed you, I was doing God's will. How can I be punished for doing God's will? And if your response is, it wasn't God's will that you murdered, my response is, then why did he die? Right? Now, if you take that line of reasoning, there could be no accountability, no responsibility for everything, for anything. Answer, the Torah absolutely, positively rejects that idea. The Torah says there is free will, and one is accountable for the choices that they make. And it may very well be that nothing could ultimately happen without God's will, for whatever reason that is, but that in no way justifies. So here is the analytical mistake. Whether you talk about reincarnation or whatever it is, that does not minimize the evil of the Nazis in doing that. And therefore, it's a very big mistake to say, oh, he's justified what the Nazis did, because that's clearly something the Torah rejects over and over again. Yeah.
For the guilt of the children.
Well, listen, if you believe in reincarnation, that could explain everything, because the child could be, something. But as they say, nobody has any way of knowing this at all. But these are possibilities. Troubled with the enormity of evil in the world, one of the straws that many religions have grasped at, not just Judaism, is the possibility of reincarnation as a partial explanation. Yeah.
One thing that scares me in faith is when God made the covenant with Abraham about his children shall be like the stars in the heaven and the sands on the beaches, and I'll also make Israel a great nation. And here we are today, numbering Jews, numbering about 15 million at the most, and Muslims.
Yep.
Numbering 250 million, I'm just kind of wondering.
Yes, where? Well, I tell you, first of all, it's interesting. People have shown that if you take the age of the Jewish people, which is as old as the Chinese, at population growth, there ought to be, billions and billions of Jews. There ought to be 6 billion Jews.